Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Summer 1967. Civil unrest in American cities. President Lyndon Johnson responds.
The civil peace has been shattered in a number of cities. The American people are deeply disturbed. They are baffled and dismayed by the wholesale looting and violence that has occurred both in small towns and in great metropolitan centers. No society can tolerate massive violence any more than a body can tolerate massive disease.
And that disease must be diagnosed, Johnson said.
What happened? Why did it happen? What can be done to prevent it from happening again and again?
And so, as governments do, Johnson commissioned a panel. It was led by Illinois Governor Otto Kerner. And the Kerner Commission's work and insights were blunt. The disease was racism and inequality.
This is our basic conclusion. Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal.
Well, that was 1968, more than 50 years ago. And of course, it's not news at all that racism and inequality have damaged the nation. It wasn't even really news back then. But why didn't Johnson, why didn't the country do more about it? Could decisions have been made back then, based on the Kerner Report, that could have changed the course of the ensuing 50 years, that could have changed what this country looks like today? Well, to start answering that, I want to turn to my guest, Fred Harris, the last surviving member of the Kerner Commission. He was a Democratic senator from the state of Oklahoma from 1964 to 1973, and he joins us now. Senator Harris, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
If I may, I just want to give listeners a taste of what it was like a little bit more in that summer of 1967. So here is a Pathé newsreel report on riots that were happening in Newark, New Jersey that year.
Newark, New Jersey became a city of race riots, violence, looting, and hate. For 5 days, it was a battleground and a looter's paradise. Colored citizens clashed with police, National Guardsmen, and state troopers. 24 people were killed and 1,200 injured. Nearly half the city was in the grip of terror.
A newsreel from 1967. So, Senator Harris, that summer, you spoke on the floor of the United States Senate. What did you say?
Well, at the height of the riots and disorders in Detroit, I went to the Senate floor. I got my seatmate, Walter Mondale, senator from Minnesota, to co-author with me a resolution to create a Blue Ribbon Citizens Commission to look into these riots, not just from the law and order standpoint, but also to get at basic causes of racism and poverty. And that was sent, that resolution was sent to the subcommittee that I headed. And I held hearings on it the very next day, and then approached President Johnson to appoint the commission himself, and that's what he did.
So you didn't want to actually wait for Congress then, it sounds like.
That's right. It occurred to me. I held hearings. I had Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, well, he wasn't a senator then, and Whitney Young, head of the Urban League, testify in favor of the commission being established. But it occurred to me that the president could wouldn't have to wait for action by Congress, but he could appoint the commission himself. And so I called Douglas Cater on his staff and then followed it up with a letter. And the president, shortly thereafter, I'm sure other people maybe had recommended the same thing, but he soon thereafter called me and said he was going to appoint that commission, and he appointed me a member of it.
Okay. So who else was on it?
Well, it was a kind of a lot of people thought it was a fairly middle-class group. There were Mayor John Lindsay was the mayor of New York City. He was vice chair of the commission. Otto Kerner, governor of Illinois, was the chair. Roy Wilkins, head of the NAACP, and Edward Brooks, Senator Brooke from Massachusetts. They were the two African-American members. Then the police chief in Atlanta, and there were two members of Congress, Representative McCulloch, and then there were two others from the outside. For example, there was a Tex Thornton, an industrialist, and Catherine Peden, who was Secretary of State in Kentucky. So it was a fairly middle-class, bland-looking group. Some people said nothing will ever come of that. And the president said to us, President Johnson said to us when he called us together by telegram in the cabinet room, he said, let your search be free and find the truth and express it in your report.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we did, much to the shock of a lot of people who expected nothing out of the commission, and to the dismay of President Johnson, who thought we had gone too far.
Well, we will talk a lot more about President Johnson and his reaction to what the Kerner Commission found or reported. But so you went off two by two in your free search, really, as you said, President Johnson put it. Now, you went with John Lindsay out to several cities across the country. Can you, first of all, like, tell us when you went to Milwaukee? Can you tell us who you talked to there and what did they tell you?
That's what we did. We authorized a lot of really good studies in depth. We also held 20 something days of hearings. Hearing from people all the way from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI. And then we divided into teams and went out ourselves to the riot cities. I was a team on a team with John Lindsay and me, a two-member team. And we went, to, among other places, to Milwaukee, as you said. And I spent the morning in Milwaukee in a black barbershop where young black men who'd come from the South fairly lately looking for jobs, about the time jobs were disappearing. And as they came in, I found them puzzled by the first question that I asked them, which was, do you find more discrimination against black people here in Milwaukee or in where you came from, Jackson, Mississippi, or somewhere like that? They were puzzled, it turned out, because they said, actually, they never saw any white people in Milwaukee. There was far more segregation in Milwaukee than where they'd come from in the South, in that northern city.
Wow. And, well, that's one of the things that hasn't really changed all that much in the ensuing 50 years, Senator. So that's what some of what you heard from citizens in Milwaukee. You also went to Cincinnati?
That's right.
Yeah, and tell us about that.
Well, it took our staff about 2 weeks to set up a meeting for John Lindsay and me with a young militant group of black men and women in Cincinnati. They didn't want to meet with us. They wouldn't even look at us. None of them would shake hands with us. Nearly all of them said, we don't want to be here. Nothing's going to come of this. You white racists like President Johnson and Vice President Hubert Humphrey, you're not going to do anything anyway. This is a waste of time. There's an enormous hostility. Now, John Lindsay and I knew basically that, but to actually see it and feel it, and it primarily centered around the police.
Mm-hmm.
There had been just such a history in these black sections of the cities police brutality and mistreatment that almost any spark could ignite the riots and disorders, and that's what happened. And the spark nearly always, I think virtually always, was the police. Another thing we did in Cincinnati, we walked around on the streets where the riots had occurred, and in about midday, we ran into on a street corner a group of young black men, 25 and under, I'd say, and they were shooting craps mm-hmm. on the street corners there. And when they saw us, John and I were in suits and ties. We had a young anti-poverty worker from that locality with us. They jumped up and they said things like, who are you, the FBI?
Can you blame them? These two white guys in suits come walking up on the street corner.
Well, this young poverty worker explained what who we were and what we were doing there. And then that group of young black men, almost in a chorus, kept saying things like, jobs, baby. Jobs is what we need. Get us a job. One young man said, President Johnson got me a job last summer, but now it's run out. He was talking about a summer job program that the president had instituted. And that was one of the takeaways for John and me when we went back to the commission meetings, jobs, and that became a central recommendation in our report.
So we're already hearing then, Senator Harris, of the strands of commonality between 1968 and 2020, right? Police, segregation, the need for economic advancement. We're going to talk a lot more about what the Kerner Commission then recommended to President Johnson when we come back. So, Senator Harris, stand by. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the Kerner Commission report, that report from 1968, which laid bare racism and inequality in America and had a raft of suggestions on how to overcome these diseases in the country. And we're asking, why did the United States not adopt those suggestions then? And what lessons should we learn now? And I'm joined today by Fred Harris. He is the last surviving member of the Kerner Commission. He was a Democratic senator from Oklahoma between 1964 to 1973. Now, Senator Harris, before we get to the specifics of what the Kerner Commission then recommended following your travels across the country talking to Americans, there's a little anecdote I want to ask you because I just read about it in an article by Jill Lepore in The New Yorker. She says that when you first talked to President Johnson to discuss the commission, President Johnson told you to remember that, quote, you were a Johnson man? Is that right?
That's right. We had gathered, it was announced that he was going to make this appointment in, with a nationwide broadcast. So we gathered some friends in our front room with a television set. And about 5 minutes before the president went on the air, my daughter, she was in, about in the third grade then, she came running in and said, President Johnson is on the phone for you. So I answered it, and he said, Fred, I'm going to appoint that commission you've been talking about, and I'm going to put you on it. And I said, well, I'll do the best I can. And he said, I want you to remember you're a Johnson man. And I said, yes, sir, I am a Johnson man. And he said, if you forget it, I'll take my pocket knife and cut your blank off.
Oh,
he did not say blank. He later, I think this is very unfortunate, but he later thought I had forgotten I was a Johnson man because he rejected our report for a number of reasons.
Right.
And well, we can go into that. And that's very sad because President Johnson really did more against racism and poverty than any president before or since. But he was misinformed about what we were recommending.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to leave Abraham Lincoln as the exception to what you just said there, Senator Harris. But the fact that President Johnson talked to you from the beginning, reminding you that you're a Johnson man, did that already make you wonder whether his heart was in the commission before the commission even set out to start its work?
No, I didn't think so, because I think President Johnson really felt very deeply the need to do something about racism, and I think that was a very central feeling of his. And he said, almost in the same words that I had put in our resolution calling for this commission, that we needed to get at deeper causes, mm-hmm. and we needed to make real the promise of America for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I want to play then a couple more clips from this time period. First of all, let's just hear Dr. Martin Luther King speaking about the publication of the Kerner Report, which happened in 1968. And King said that society will be better equipped to deal with racial prejudice when evidence of that prejudice is out in the open for everyone to see.
My analysis was no more pessimistic or gloomy than the Kerner Commission's report the other day. I do feel that we've got to say in no uncertain terms that racism is alive and on the throne in American society, and that we are moving toward two societies, separate and unequal, and if something isn't done to stop this in a very determined manner, things can really get worse.
Dr. King in 1968. Now here is Governor Otto Kerner, the commission chair, reading from the Kerner Commission report. This is from a 1968 CBS News special.
To pursue our present course will involve the continuing polarization of the American community and ultimately the destruction of basic democratic values. The alternative will require a commitment to national action, compassionate, massive, and sustained, backed by the resources of the most powerful and richest nation on the earth.
That's Otto Kerner in 1968. So, Senator Harris, what do you think the most important conclusions and recommendations of the commission were?
Well, we recommended massive and sustained new federal programs, jobs, education, training, housing, vigorous enforcement of the fairly new civil rights laws, integration of the schools and of housing. We thought, and we also made very strong recommendations about reform of the police. We said the police ought to look like the community where they're working. They ought to be a part of the community. We were against the militarization of the police, and we thought that we were very much in favor of what came to be called community policing.
Mm-hmm. So those are some of the practical observations and recommendations that the commission made. But it went even deeper. It identified white racism as sort of the core pathogen in the American body politic, right? I mean, the report says race prejudice has shaped our history decisively. It now threatens to affect our future. White racism is essentially responsible for the explosive mixture which has been accumulating in our cities since the end of World War II. Can you talk to me about what the discussions were like amongst the commission members that led to passages like that being put in the report?
Well, our report was eventually adopted unanimously, but in the interior, as we were talking about some of these things, for example, saying the word racism, we had 6-5 votes. There were some who thought, well, we ought to be a little more gentle about it. We ought to say the word discrimination or intolerance. But we thought it was really important to say that white racism, as we did say, white racism have created these black ghettos in the country, and it's white racism that sustains them. And that was a shock, I think, to people. But I think it was really important to say it, and we were the first government agency ever to use that word.
6-5, though? So the report, as you said, was unanimously approved.
Yes, our executive director later said this is the only unanimous report which was adopted by a vote of 6-5. What happened was, by the time we had gone through all of this, we spent 40-something days reading aloud every word of that 400-page report and voting on the words. And after we'd gone through the studies that we had authorized to be made and the surveys, and we ourselves had gone around the country and we'd considered this in depth, everybody came to the same conclusion that we should say the basic cause of these riots is white racism and the combination of white racism with desperate poverty.
Huh. So, if I have this right, civil rights activists at the time did not expect the commission's report to so bluntly and plainly say that racism is the problem in America.
That's true, and we made a bad mistake, I think, in the Kerner Commission in not bringing the people along with us. Our hearings, for example, were closed. Nobody even thought about opening them up. We should have had them quite open. And when people like John Lindsay and I walked around to these riot cities, we should have had the press with us so that they would have seen what we saw and heard what we heard, and it wouldn't have been such a shock when we later said those things. My father, I'll say we had one other development which cut down on the impact of the report, and that was we had intended to allow considerable time for backgrounding the press before and the media before we turned the report loose or made it public. But there was a leak of the summary of the report, an unauthorized leak, and I think with bad intention to lessen its impact. And so all of a sudden, the headlines the next day were white racism, cause of black riots, mm-hmm. Commission says. My father was a small farmer in southwestern Oklahoma. He loved me. But the way he heard that the report was something like this: Mr. Harris, out of the goodness of your heart, you ought to pay more taxes to help poor black people who are rioting in Detroit. And his reaction was, to hell with that, I'm paying too much tax already, and what about my problems? He was right. We said in our report that what we were recommending applied to everybody, not just black people, rural and urban, white and black, Spanish surnamed, American Indians, and other minorities. But that whole story really never got across as much as we wanted it to.
Well, it's in a sense, it's not surprising that that part didn't get across because, as we just talked about, the report was also so plain in its speaking about racism that in terms of how people saw the country was really the thing that got a lot of focus. Now, I want to turn back to something that we talked about earlier about you being Senator Harris, you being that Johnson man, because then it's President Johnson himself that basically he immediately just shelved the report as soon as the Kerner Commission published it. I just want to play a little bit from a conversation that President Johnson had with then Chicago Mayor Richard Daley in March of 1968, where Johnson complains to Daley that John Lindsay, the mayor of New York City and the vice chair of the commission who'd written up the report, that he'd gone way too far in his recommendations. And just warning to listeners, President Johnson uses some Johnsonian language here.
I didn't realize when I appointed Kerner that this son of a bitch from New York, Lindsay, would take charge. He did take charge. And he recommended I hire 2.5 million people on federal payroll. And I just, I've not wanted to reflect on Kerner and criticize the commission. At the same time, I couldn't embrace it because I've got a budget. When I came in, Kennedy had a budget of $97 billion. My budget tonight's $187 billion. Now, that's what's happened in 4 years.
President Johnson in March of 1968, and one of the reasons for that ballooning budget was, of course, the Vietnam War. Now, Senator Harris, President Johnson, though he appointed this commission, he didn't even write the commission members thank you letters when you turned in the sum of your efforts, and he did nothing, as far as I can tell, to advance the recommendations of the commission. How did you feel when that happened?
Well, we were quite disappointed. We were expecting to have a ceremony where we would turn over our report, and we were going to ask for 6 months of additional life for the commission so that we could lobby for and advocate for our recommendations. But we learned that all along, Johnson was getting reports that John Lindsay and I were running the commission and we were going too far and too fast. And we also learned that a member of Congress got some leak from the commission, and he said to Johnson in advance, he'd never read the report, and neither had Johnson, but he said to the president, these were exact words as we understood it, this report is going to ruin you. It doesn't say a kind word about any good thing you've done in regard to race or poverty, and it encourages and condones riots. That was not true. None of that was true, but Johnson did not know it. I had several conversations with Johnson while the commission was at work, and he believed that there was some conspiracy behind these riots, mm-hmm. that they were planned, organized by outside agitators, and I tried to disabuse him of that belief, but I never was able to.
Wow. Well, Senator Harris, I'd like you to hang on here for just a minute. This has been absolutely fascinating because now I want to start drawing out the lessons that we should have learned 50 years ago. More than 50 years ago, and start applying them to today. So if you can hang on for just a moment, I want to bring into the conversation now Professor Elizabeth Hinton. She is an incoming professor of history, law, and African-American studies at Yale University and author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. Professor Hinton, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
So pick up where Senator Harris has left off here. I mean, first of all, tell us why you understand that President Johnson, even though he had fought so hard for the war on poverty, which you've written extensively about, He didn't take that momentum and carry it forward in applying the recommendations of the Kerner Commission.
Right. And that's one of the big kind of missed opportunities of the Johnson administration, especially at the very end of his administration. I think, you know, as we've been talking about, the Kerner Commission's emphasis on white racism really made Johnson and a lot of other policymakers
Professor Hinton, we're going to get you back on a better line here. What you're saying is too important for us to have these drop out. So hang on. We're going to try and get you back on a better line. Senator Harris, while we work on that, can you just tell me in the minute that we have before the break, do you think there's anything that the commission members themselves could have or should have done to change Johnson's mind about not acting on your recommendations?
Well, I tried to. For example, I was down there to the White House for some other reason once during the work of this commission, and he said to me, he said something about he thought there were outside agitators and some conspiracy behind the riots. And I said, no, it isn't like that, Mr. President. I said, I knew he was a student of Franklin Roosevelt's, and I said, who knows what kind of ideology or what sort of explosions may have occurred if President Roosevelt hadn't taken away the causes for the unrest. And he said, have you read the FBI reports?
Well, Senator Harris, hang out here for just a second. I'll let you finish that story when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are looking back at the Kerner Commission report from 1968. It was one report, a landmark report, that laid bare racism and inequality as a disease in America that was harming all Americans, but of course, especially Black Americans. It also had exhaustive recommendations on what to do to create a healthier society. President Johnson, who commissioned the report, ignored it as well. And we're trying to understand why and what difference it might have made 50 years later had the Kerner Commission's recommendations been followed. And we're talking today with Senator Fred Harris. He's the last surviving member of the Kerner Commission. He was a Democratic senator from Oklahoma from 1964 to 1973. And we're trying to get Professor Elizabeth Hinton back on the line. And I just want to take a second to explain to listeners, because this seems to happen a lot these days. But usually we would send guests to studios that have pretty solid connections with us here. But in the era of the COVID pandemic, we've been talking to people at home over apps on the internet. So sometimes the internet is an unreliable friend in producing live radio. So we're troubleshooting that right now. But Senator Harris, you were telling us a story before I had to take a quick break there about trying to convince President Johnson to act on the commission's recommendations. Do you want to finish that story?
Well, he'd read these FBI reports, and they mostly mentioned about each particular riot or disorder. They particularly mentioned some outside the agitator. For example, I remember from the Cambridge, Maryland report of the FBI, there was a mention that a source close to this bureau says that H. Rapp Brown was 2 weeks ahead of time here and so forth. And they sort of thought these reports. Now, J. Edgar Hoover didn't think that the riots were organized, but Some of these reports indicated that, and that's what Johnson was reading. Mm. But I want to just say that civil rights was in the air. We'd lately passed, Congress had, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Civil Rights Act of 64. The anti-poverty program was getting underway, and Johnson was able to get Congress to pass, with the recommendations of the Kerner Commission, a fair housing law after the report. And we've made progress on virtually every aspect of race and poverty, desegregation of the schools and of housing and so forth, narrowing of the achievement gap in reading between African-American kids and white kids. All of that was happening. But meantime, Richard Nixon was being elected president, talking a lot about law and order, and later President Reagan. And the Congress began to change. The politics of the country did. The courts turned their backs. And we began to slow that advance and then even reverse it. And today there are far more, millions more people who are poor. We've got terrible violence by the police against, or some of them, against African Americans in particular. There's an emboldened white racism in this country. An emboldened white supremacy movement in this country. And we're resegregating schools and housing, and worsening the inequality of wealth and income in the country.
Right. Senator Harris, your point is well taken. And if I just may respectfully say, I also hear you still being that Johnson man and trying to take the president off the hook here a little bit. But I think everything that you just said, now we've got Professor Hinton back on the line, so I'll turn to her. Professor Hinton, everything that Senator Harris just said, I hear as exactly the reasons why we have to wonder what opportunities were lost, given the momentum that the senator's talking about, that, you know, between basically 64 through 67 or 68, the opportunities lost by not furthering the recommendations of the commission's report.
Right, Meghna, that's a really good point. And thank you again for having me. And I apologize for my connection issues. You know, I think that part of the reason why Johnson kind of clung to this theory that outside agitators, as Senator Harris said, were responsible for the unrest is because that would have caused him to really call into question some of the major shortcomings of the war on poverty, and the fact that the war on poverty did not go far enough to address the underlying socioeconomic conditions that the Kerner Commission mentioned and really emphasized in its report. And I think that failed opportunity that was the kind of main argument the Kerner Commission made, that we are going to have future unrest in the United States and absent of a major structural intervention to deal with and confront the underlying causes of unrest. In addition to white racism, even more so, failing public schools, mass unemployment. You know, we heard Johnson complain in that clip that you played earlier of Lindsay wanting to, you know, put 2.5 million African Americans on the payroll. This is something that he was unwilling to do, an investment in new and decent housing for people. These were the reasons, even though police were the proximate cause we've been talking about, these were the underlying reasons the Kerner Commission discovered were responsible for the unrest. And the federal government was unwilling to actually put that kind of investment back in to really confront and deal with the problem of inequality in America.
So this is such an important point here. And to buttress what you're saying, Professor Hinton, I want to play a clip from Kenneth Clark, the famed psychologist who testified, as Senator Harris, I'm sure, remembers, who testified before the commission. Now, Clark had actually warned the Kerner Commission not to repeat the same conclusions that had happened in multiple commissions, but even before the 1960s, you know, for basically roughly 50 years of American history prior to that. He called it a kind of Alice in Wonderland with the same moving picture reshown over and over again, the same analysis, the same recommendations, and the same inaction. And here's more of what he said. He told this to CBS News in 1968.
this society believes that it can have its affluence and its injustice at the same time. And it will continue to believe this until it becomes excruciatingly clear that it's impossible. It will not, if we're going to judge from the past, it will not plan to eradicate slums. It will not allocate the resources to get rid of our ghettos. And to me, only this will prevent riots and instability for the future.
That's psychologist Kenneth Clark speaking to CBS News in 1968. So, Professor Hinton, what lessons do we need to be drawing right now? Because it seems as if there's this profound groundswell of public desire for action, for meaningful action. Do we run the same risk, though, of having it being inadequate action?
Mm-hmm. And we also, I think, run the risk of going the path that the federal government did end up pursuing, which is not major structural change in the realm of jobs and housing and employment, but a new crime control program and the modernization of American police forces. I think that Clark's insight that there's this balance between affluence and injustice is something that, again, absent the kind of redistribution of resources that the Kerner Commission advocated and a major structural intervention in the 60s, we're still very much dealing with that legacy today. And I think that that question has become forefront in the ways that we're talking about racial inequality. I think that, you know, especially white Americans are beginning to realize that if we're going to have racial justice in this country, it means that they are going to have to give something up. You know, we cannot, that means that in order to make that balance that Clark was talking about, we're going to have to think about, you know, how we can get resources to the people that need them most. And again, that means that the status quo can no longer be maintained. And there has been historically a real resistance to disrupting that status quo and to disrupting the racial hierarchies that have defined the United States since its founding.
Oh, so can you tell me more about then some of the lessons we ought to be learning here? Because I hear you saying that that there was sort of a, maybe this is a simplistic metaphor, but like a fork in the road, and Johnson himself and then definitely Nixon thereafter went down the law and order fork instead of the investment in communities road.
Right. And I think, you know, what's interesting, that some of the Kerner Commission's recommendations did get adopted. And many of those were the recommendations in terms of improving policing. And those recommendations that reinforced another crime commission that Johnson convened in the 60s, which was the Crime Commission, which he did not turn his back from in the way that he did the Kerner Commission. In fact, the Crime Commission had 2 years to essentially develop the blueprint that would become the first major piece of federal crime control legislation. So I think that, you know, one of the lessons is that path, that investment in policing and surveillance in prisons really prompted as a riot control program initially has not worked to solve the underlying inequalities that the Kerner Commission pointed out. It is time that we try a different policy path, one that invests in communities. I think that's what, you know, many of these conversations about defunding the police or divest and invest, this fork in the road and this in the 60s and this decision to invest in the war on crime and later the war on drugs in the 80s and to lock people up as a way to manage the problems that led to unrest has not worked, and it has not been a long-term solution to addressing the underlying unrest that we see emerging today.
Mm-hmm. So, Senator Harris, you've been listening patiently, and I thank you for that.
Sure.
Do you feel more hopeful today than you did, say, in 1972?
Yes, much. There's a great deal of difference in these protests and demonstrations today. First of all, they're multi-ethnic, multi-racial, white, black, they cut across all sorts of lines, age, generation. Plus, there's more activism, progressive activism today in America than I've ever seen in my lifetime. I believe that we're at an inflection point. I think the great danger is that some would try to lead us off only to the law and order aspects of these problems. And then I think there's also danger that we just get focused on, for example, removing statues. I think that's absolutely necessary to do that, remove those objectionable statues. But that's not going to get at these deeper problems. We need to keep our eye on the prize. I think we need commissions, reconciliation commissions, or whatever you want to call them. There's a role for civic action here, communitization of these problems, where we get together and talk. For example, here in New Mexico, there's a movement to get rid of the statues of Oñate, who was a brutal a Spanish colonialist here. And I think we need a reconciliation commission here and in lots of places where we get at, say, for example, to Hispanics and Native Americans, our ancestors fought each other, but we don't have to. We've got the same problems with the racism and with discrimination and with poverty, and we ought to get together and try to solve those basic problems.
Right.
That's our need, and I think there's a chance we can do it. This may be our last chance to do away with the results of racism and to do away with poverty.
Senator Harris, we just got a little bit of time, tiny bit of time left with you. I want to ask you one more question. I'm thinking about that story you told us about your father and what he heard, even though he heard an incomplete message from the very commission that you worked on, and his response. You know that there is a similar response coming from some white Americans now. Given your experience from 1968, what would you tell them?
We're all in this thing together. You know, there's that book, What's the Matter with Kansas, leading off on cross-cutting issues, as has often been done by conservatives, anti-communism or law and order or whatever. People vote against, have been many of them, voting against their own interests. And our interests, for most people, are the same. We're not going to have a stable and secure society of self-esteem until we get at these basic problems of racism and inequality and inequities. And I believe that we can sell. It's a tough message, but it's a true message. I think we can sell the idea that everybody does better when everybody does better.
Right. Well, Professor Hinton, we've just got a minute left to go, and I'm hearing Senator Harris call for reconciliation. I don't necessarily think we need another commission to come to the same conclusions. So what do you think? So I want to differentiate between a commission and a reconciliation process. But in the last minute that we have, what do you want listeners to come away with as the biggest lessons we ought to be applying today from the Kerner Commission?
Well, I think reconciliation is important in the sense that it helps us grapple with our history. I think that, you know, we are just beginning to see, you know, the ways in which racism is systemic in this country, and the ways in which our history has led to the inequalities that we are still confronting with today. So I think that understanding our history as a historian is very important. But also, yes, we don't need another commission. What we need is action. We know what we need. We need to reinvest resources in ways that allow for a reimagining of what public safety means. Mm-hmm. And we know that this law and order crime control policy path as a way to manage inequality for the past 50 years has simply not worked. And
right.
It's time to try something else.
Well, Elizabeth Hinton is a professor of history, law, and African-American studies, soon to be at Yale, and author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. Professor Hinton, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Senator Fred Harris, the last surviving member of the Kerner Commission, it has been an absolute honor and so fascinating to speak with you, Senator Harris. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.